It's kind of fitting that the movie Nightcrawler opens today on Halloween because it covers the lurid world of a freelance video reporter played by Jake Gyllenhaal with manic, hollowed eyes who pursues crime and accidents around Los Angeles. It also stars Rene Russo and Bill Paxton, and while it marks the directing debut of Dan Gilroy, he's no stranger to movies, having written quite a few, including The Fall, Real Steel, and The Bourne Legacy, which he co-wrote with his brother Tony Gilroy. And Tony, who is a well-respected director in his own right, only helped produce this film. But I'm delighted that it has brought both Gilroy brothers to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Nice to see you.
And we could have had a third Gilroy brother who's also involved in this.
John Gilroy is on the West Coast. He was the editor of the film. He's edited Tony's films as well. And I think he's the secret sauce in what we do in some ways.
This is kind of a family affair?
It is a family affair, yeah. I mean, it was a family affair in the sense that Tony was the first person I gave the script to. And you introduced him as only the producer. I would say his role as a producer was instrumental in not only helping get the momentum of the project going, but certainly in helping guide me as I followed a career trajectory that he had taken with Michael Clayton.
Because he's already directed film, so he could give you some advice.
Right.
And then, Dan, your wife, Rene Russo, is in this film.
She is. I actually wrote the part for her, the part of Nina, who's the news director at the lowest rated station in Los Angeles and rather desperate. And I wrote it for her because the character, I think, could have easily been reduced to a hard-nosed businesswoman. And I thought what Renee found in the character was a tremendous vulnerability that really deepened what we had.
Were you close as kids?
Yeah, we have very tribal, very tight family. I mean, we really did.
Your father was in the movie business before he started writing plays.
We grew up in Washingtonville, New York, upstate, sort of a random place to be, and way
it's
out
up
of
by
the
West
business.
Point.
Yeah, way out of the movie business on purpose. And my father was an only child, and I think that the idea of fraternity, nothing culty about it, but I think he really made sure that we were did everything he could to make sure we were tight.
And interested in the movies? Well, he's probably best known for his Tony and Pulitzer Prize-winning play, the subject was roses, but he did a lot of movies. So, was this a subject of conversation over the dinner table?
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of like living above a shoe store. If your father's the cobbler, I mean, he worked at home most of the time, or when he'd be away, you grow up with it peripherally. It's just something you just sort of take for granted. And
we watched him take the career path that Tony and I have both taken, which is a writer. Mm-hmm. Who finally decided he didn't want to see his work altered to the
point. So he directed as well.
He's probably directed, a half a dozen of independent
Seven movies.
Films.
Yeah.
What's your mother been doing during all this time?
Everything.
She's been doing everything. I'd say she's as big an inspiration in every way in our lives as our father is. And, I mean, she taught me so much. I mean.
Yeah, that's an impossibly comprehensive list of
She's arguably the most intelligent and the most creative person in
the
family.
The most well-read, yes. So.
Well, John is Dan's twin.
Yes.
So that makes things even more complicated, doesn't it?
Well, not complicated in the sense that we're very close. So when it came to, say, cutting the film for me, I'm in a room with somebody for 4 months who I feel inordinately close to.
And even look a lot alike.
We don't look a lot
alike,
nor do we communicate telepathically. However, we have great empathy for each other, and we seem to be on the same wavelength creatively.
So did all of you, when you were growing up, expect to go into the movies?
No, not at all. I think not at all.
No. I wanted to be a stuntman. Well, I guess that's what I wanted to be in the movies. I actually did want to be a stuntman. But.
And I was a musician for a long time, and I think we wandered wandered around and there must be some when you try a lot of different things in your life and you finally keep trying things, you're sort of like water. You go where they like you. And storytelling, I think, for all three of us, because what Johnny's job is essentially storytelling. There's just an incredible comfort there.
Then there was the move to Los Angeles, Dan.
We were born in Los Angeles, but then
we raised upstate
in New York, and then I met my wife Renee on a film 20 years ago, and I moved to Los Angeles to be with her. So I've been living in Los Angeles for 20 years now, although I still consider myself to be a New Yorker.
And does this grow out of that experience? Because this is about Los Angeles at night. I always think of Los Angeles as this sun-drenched place, and this is a A very dark Los Angeles.
Yeah, well, it grew out of being in Los Angeles in the sense that while I've been living there, I heard about this group of people called stringers / nightcrawlers who go out.
They're
at
actually
night.
Called nightcrawlers.
They call themselves. They euphemistically call themselves nightcrawlers. I think on a better day, they like to think of themselves as stringers, in the sense that that's a more traditional journalistic description. But
well, stringers are usually like freelance reporters.
Which is what they are. These are freelance videographers who go out at night. There's a vacuum from 10 to 6 in the morning when the traditional local television news networks do not send out crews. They fill the vacuum. And I heard about this world, and I thought it was a very interesting backdrop for a film.
How does the way they do local television news in Los Angeles compare with TV news on the West, on the East Coast?
Well, I think it's brighter, it's more lurid. Tony says you have to wear sunglasses when you watch local television news in Los Angeles. It's the home of the car chase. It's the home where at any moment four or five stations will instantly cut to a 3-hour chase of a poor little Honda Tercel or whatever, Toyota Tercel.
The O.J. Simpson trial really gave you a sort of an infected the rest of the country with kind of the vibe of it when the aesthetic of L.A. News came national with that story.
And these guys troll CB radios for news of accidents. There are a lot of accidents. I know just going down the freeway, they used to be, I don't know, I haven't been in L.A. for a little while, used to be signs saying there was an accident here, drive safely.
The sig alerts, yeah.
Yeah, a lot of the sig alerts. Yeah, they have actually between a half a dozen or more scanners going at one time on every band, and they're covering roughly 800 square miles of Los Angeles, and it's a very competitive job, very competitive.
How did you come up with the character of Lou Bloom?
I'm very empathetic and in tune with the plight of many young people today who are going into the job market and being offered internships and minimal pay. So the first point of departure was coming up with a character who was desperate for work. And I narratively decided to try to go for the classic hero, but I quickly realized that the anti-hero plugged into the story better.
Although he's nothing like the character Leo Bloom in Joyce's Ulysses in Night Town, have to see some connection.
There is a connection to a degree. I think the reason I went with the name Bloom is I was symbolically interested in a character who blooms, who literally blooms in his career.
But you have Night Town and Nightcrawler.
There's a few similarities. I think Joyce probably stole that from me.
His story can be seen as a quintessential American success story on the one hand. On the other hand, there's something a little off about this guy that creeps up on us as we're watching the film.
Well, he falls under the diagnostic label of sociopath. Mm-hmm. But I think one of the things that I and Jake, and particularly Jake, in exploring the character we're trying to find was an inner humanity of the character. We're hoping that people watch the film and walk out and perhaps feel connected to him in a way that they didn't expect. And they might think about what is it about me that responds to this character.
And this is a difficulty in creating an unpleasant character. You still have to make the audience connect to him on some level. We're rooting for him to succeed at the same time that we're horrified by what he's doing.
I think there's actually a really interesting cultural shift that's happened right now through television and from Sopranos and a whole variety of things that are coming at us. I think that we were beaten up. Danny and I were beaten up coming to age as of age in the 80s and 90s in classical movie training writing. Always sympathetic character, always backstory, all this information.
And you give him no backstory here.
Well, you're now seeing the real thing is the characters have to be fascinating. And you have to find some way of being complicit with that fascination. And that's what this movie is really delivering, I think.
He is incredibly focused. And the scene in the beginning when he's trying to get a job in a scrap metal yard is both heartrending and still very funny.
Well, that's actually what would you in today's job market, bleak job market, that's called an elevator speech. And the concept is that if you ever find yourself in an elevator with somebody who could possibly give you employment, you should be able to sell yourself within 30 seconds. And that's a function in that scene of Lou's desperation and fanaticism of climbing the ladder.
My guests are Dan Gilroy, writer-director of Nightcrawler, which opens today in theaters around town. Tony Gilroy, also a writer-director who produced this film, which stars Jake Gyllenhaal, Rene Russo, Riz Ahmed, and Bill Paxton. Some people will see echoes of Network here. What films were you thinking about, or were you thinking about
Network? Network is legitimate in the sense that it's about journalism. I think what Network captured was the moment in time when news departments were forced to make a profit. And I think what Paddy Chayefsky brilliantly foresaw is that when news departments have to make a profit, news becomes entertainment. So it's legitimate in that sense. I was more intrigued and studying the films that had anti-heroes. It was a film like Rupert Pupkin in King of Comedy or Nicole Kidman in To Die For.
What about Medium Cool?
A Medium Cool in the sense that, yeah, it does have to do with journalism to some degree.
Well, it's about a Chicago TV cameraman who comes upon an accident on the highway.
I haven't seen that in a long time. The Haskell Wexler film, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
He's a great cinematographer
as well.
Oh,
my God. He certainly is.
When did Jake Gyllenhaal come on board? Was he your first choice?
He was right at the top of the list. I finished the script. Tony and Jennifer Fox, the producer, came on board, and agencies were intrigued because, as Tony said, fascinating characters get traction. Jake read it. I flew to Atlanta where he was doing Prisoners, and we had a four-hour dinner in which it became very apparent that we were creatively utterly in tune with where we wanted to go.
He looks almost haunted here. Did he lose weight for the role?
It was Jake's idea to have the symbolic totem animal of a coyote. And coyotes are perpetually lean and hungry. And that was that worked for the character in an aesthetic sense. It gave Jake, as you pointed out, this sunken, you know, eyed, hollow-cheeked look. But I thought what it gave him as well was this tremendously odd, dangerous energy of literal hunger. I always feel like he's ready to consume people and ideas, and if he was running a country, to consume the world.
He spouts off a lot of figures about the ratings of local news. Did you invent them, or are those real figures?
No, those are in the ballpark.
Because he's almost an authority on it.
Well, he studied them, and actually that came from the research I did. There's some leeway in the statistical accuracy of it, but those numbers are generally true, and they're done by USC study and several other. Annenberg, I think, did a study as well.
Rene Russo is also wonderful in this film. It must be nice to get a great performance from your wife. I love her line to Lou, which she says in all seriousness, "Think of our newscast as a screaming woman running down the street with her throat cut."
Yeah, well, that's a description I think that goes all the way back to tabloids on Fleet Street. You know, I don't think that's something that they've invented. I think it's something that has got a historical precedent that goes back to the beginning of journalism.
What were some of the things that you couldn't have imagined in making the transition from screenwriter to director, Tony?
You know, you spend all your life in a room, and you spend all your life by yourself, and nobody helps you when you're writing. There's nobody who cares. Nobody can really help you. Suddenly you end up in an environment where you have the great opportunity to be hoisted up by so many remarkable people. And it's a completely different experience.
On the other hand, I'd imagine that when you're writing a script, you're kind of seeing the scene as it might be filmed.
Oh, completely. And
and then some director takes it over and does it totally differently, and it
sometimes
may be
better.
Nice, and sometimes you might think, oh, boy, why did he do that to my script?
I think ultimately I think if you're writing really well, if you're writing scripts, you're always writing. You're always seeing the movie, and I think that there's a real dissonance over time if you're really committed to watching that break down. And if you have any ability, any kind of social skills or any kind of managerial abilities whatsoever, you want to take charge of one and at least see how it went. And for Clayton, that was me. I said, I want to do at least one that I take full responsibility for.
Were there certain things that you remember that caught you off guard when you were doing Michael Clayton?
Oh, so many things. I mean, you just the transition is really epic because they're very, very different. The thing I'll say about this and what Danny's going through now is this is a purely singular voice. And when you have someone directing their original screenplay and it's tidy, you have a very, very unique opportunity.
Well, this is the European idea, the auteur, where the writer also directs.
Right.
And there are arguments on both sides. But you brought out a side of George Clooney at that time that most people hadn't seen before. And we realized he had a lot more acting chops than we thought. And now we have Jake Gyllenhaal in doing something in this film that we have not seen him do before.
Well, you know, one of the things that intrigued me about Jake years ago is he either publicly or certainly publicly to some degree came out and said, I'm turning my back on classic commercial Hollywood films. I want to challenge myself. I want to do things that are relevant and important to me. And I think as an artist, it was very unique, and it was very intriguing to me to work with somebody who has announced that to
himself.
He's
made a lot of very ambitious choices even prior to this film, and I think he'll probably continue to. Look, George, the same thing. It's at a certain point, you look around, and how much money do I need, and how much of the rest of this do I need, and I really am an actor.
And he also winds up becoming a director.
Exactly.
Since this film can be seen as critical of the way local news programs work, was it hard to get local news anchors to play themselves?
Unbelievably, enough. No.
Every really? So much want to be. Well, we're all in the same union these days, so it's pretty easy. SAG-AFTRA.
We're all just one big brotherhood.
No, but as a producer, you know, you go around and making films, and you're
role, even though I'm in.
You know what?
It's coming your way now.
I think you've just announced. But we were, as producers, Jen and I were just. They'd go out and they'd say, "We have all these people," and we'd say, "Well, did you show them the entire script?" And because you get in trouble losing locations and losing people when the big boss hasn't seen the whole thing. And we were, it was astonishing that all of the local news people signed off on being it, and they're
these
happy
the
with them. They're happy with the movie. They come to the screenings,
even though the movie, in effect, is an indictment of if it bleeds, it leads.
I think in many of their minds, that was the idea that we don't do that, but I know stations that do.
Did you? What about shooting in Los Angeles? You don't give us the Los Angeles that we're used to. So was it really important to find certain kinds of locations?
It was very important to get a particular look. I find Los Angeles to be physically beautiful. And Robert Elswit, the amazing, the wonderful cinematographer who shot the film, and I sat down, and we decided to shoot L.A. in a way that captured a wild, untamed energy.
Anthony Lane, in his rave review in The New Yorker, wrote, "The movie is quite something, and despite its title, it doesn't really crawl. It scuttles ahead, wide-eyed, antennae waving on a journey to the end of the night and toward a future when nothing will not be shown. Don't look now, it tells us, so we do." The film is Nightcrawler. It opens around town. And my great thanks to Dan and Tony Gilroy for being on our show today.
What a pleasure.
Thank you.